You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 177 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And welcome to October. We are fully in the swing of football season. Lots is happening, not baseball, of course, but lots is happening.
Fully in the swing of the soccer season.
Everywhere else, we've got soccer, we've got baseball, and...
Wait, we've got baseball?
Or sorry, we've got soccer, we've got football, and we've got this week's beer.
Oh, what a transition here. All right, we are drinking the Intergalactic Deals Vanilla Shake Double IPA. And here's the description from our friends Tavor, our sponsor Tavor. If aliens ever come down to Earth and threaten to destroy us all, I'll probably just hand them a can of today's Intergalactic Deals Vanilla Milkshake IPA. Then I'll watch them pour this 4.14 rated juice bomb into their weird alien faces, and I'll bet any amount of money that their eyes or antenna or whatever will light up with appreciation. Either that or I'll be immediately vaporized. One of the two. But I tell you this, I know my chances of surviving an alien encounter will be way better with a few cans of this delicious milkshake IPA from Pennsylvania's Levante. Their hazy brews even beat out other half and tired hands in Hop Culture's blind taste test. And Intergalactic Deals blast the juicy flavors all the way out past Pluto. It's loaded with real Madagascar vanilla, a heap of local honey, lactose, your favorite, and a whole galaxy's worth of Centennial, Amarillo, Eldorado, and Mosaic hops.
Are you doing like a mumble rap thing here? I feel like your enunciation was not very clear. You're down in the mix.
That was just a lot of words there to read.
Okay.
So this made me think of the fact that I recently had a nightmare.
Oh, no.
We were recording a podcast during that, an alien
that
attack.
That is a nightmare. Wait, we were recording a podcast? Oh, the aliens came too.
Yes.
Okay.
And for some reason, I was like remarkably unconcerned about the alien spacecraft that was blotting out the sun Independence Day style and the fighter jets that were being scrambled from Boeing Field, which we were overlooking. So you would think we were doing this podcast in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast, except that apparently we were doing it in a stadium too. So it was a very weird
stadium.
Nightmare.
Look, yep. A Jalen Ramsey emergency podcast awaits for no one. And no creature or being.
We're not trading for Jalen Ramsey. Anyway, our beer is sponsored by Tavor. Tavor is an app that offers craft beers that aren't distributed nationwide for purchase. Local breweries like Levante Brewing make their beers available to Tavor. You order the ones you like and they'll be shipped together on a regular basis for a flat shipping cost. We're drinking beer sent to us by Tavor on the pod each week, and you can take advantage too. If you sign up for an account with Tavor and enter the code PELTONCAST in the promo section, you'll get $10 credit after spending your first $25 with Tavor.
All right.
All right, let's get to the toasts. We start with our friend Megan Verpino, who was named the best FIFA women's player 2019.
The Ballon d'Or.
It's not the Ballon. That gets given out in January, so I don't really understand what the difference here is. But I guess that's not awarded officially by FIFA. She joins Mia Hamm, Carly Lloyd, and Abby Wambach is the fourth American player to win since the award was first given out in 2001.
Wow.
Select company for sure. Speaking of Rapinoe.
Without even playing in many of the most important matches.
Oh, yes. No, just one.
Okay, it was still like missing and
I mean, she still
match.
Won the Golden Boot. She was still the player of the World Cup. So
pretty
no
incredible.
Surprising in a year where there is a World Cup that the player who wins the...
Were you going to point out that she missed some of the World Cup victory tour games?
I thought you were mentioning that she missed many Reign FC games.
Oh, that too.
But despite that, Reign FC clinched a playoff berth with Sunday's 2-0 win over the rival Portland Thorns at Cheney Stadium.
The hated Thorns.
Real derby match there between the Reign and the Thorns. There are thorns in our side. Not this year, actually. We'll get to that later.
You've got some news here that I'm unaware of.
Yes. Moving right along. Since I guess we have no non-sports stuff this week.
You said you had a story to tell.
No, the story to tell was the nightmare.
Oh, that was the nightmare? Well, you wanted me to tell my other story, which sort of relates to Husky football.
Sure.
So we were going to Vashon Island for my middle of the 10 children. So six, number six, five or six, can't remember.
It's actually child 5.5.
5.5. So we were going on to the Fauntleroy Ferry at rush hour traffic on a Friday.
Was your whole family with you, or were you by yourself from work?
My whole family was with me.
Okay.
Everybody was in the car. So we're waiting in this giant line, right? If you've ever waited for the Fauntleroy Ferry at rush hour, you're waiting super far back past the park, right? And so my wife and two of the children get out to go to the bathroom, right? But I'm still driving along as the cars are moving forward to get on the ferry. So all of a sudden, they're like running after the car as I'm moving. And at some point, I stopped. Literally, a car tried to sneak in front of me in the line. And then, like, an old-school Vashon person came out of their car and yelled at that person. It was like, that's not the way it works.
Wow.
Yeah. The people are serious about that ferry. So we wait in this line. Eventually, we get to the front. We go through. We pay to get on the ferry. And then Mrs. Fantasy Genius realizes that all of my children have multiple allergic reactions to things. And so she realizes that she's dropped the bag of EpiPens that we have, right? Did you not hear this part of the story?
No, I didn't know this one.
And so we had no idea where it was, but assumed it was somewhere pretty far back toward the park, which you can imagine is like a pretty long distance. It's like a half mile or so.
Yeah.
And so we're parking, waiting. The ferry is literally coming. Like, we can see the ferry coming. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go back and get them. I'm faster or whatever. Because the cost of these EpiPens, thank you, Martin Shkreli, is incredible, right? It's like, we need to get these back.
Yeah.
So she gets in the driver's seat. I'm like, fuck it. I'll just get on a later ferry. I'll have a great time sitting alone. I will eat some chowder and drink a beer and be happy, right? So then I run along the street out of the ferry terminal area, onto the street, up the hill, find these EpiPens, right? And then I see that the ferry is there and hasn't left yet, and I'm like, I guess I'm going for it. So I'm like running as fast as I can back, and I get there. I pay for another ticket to go in. The dude's like at the gate is like, you better hurry. He's like, the boat's leaving. You better go. Scan the thing. So I do that. I'm like carrying these EpiPens. I am sweating profusely.
This
right?
is important context to
sweat
the story.
Sweat is pouring off of
sad
me.
Sad I missed this previously.
As I'm doing this. And I literally, I'm like jumping onto the boat as it's about to leave. And I look over and who do I see?
There's one other person behind you?
There was one, they had a child with them in like a little bag. But it was only me and them getting on the boat. But!
I'm sorry, a child with them in a little bag?
They had like a backpack or whatever.
Uh-huh.
1991 Washington Husky national champion Joel McHale is there with me.
That's how he typically gets introduced, yes.
He is in full-on Jeff Winger mode, too. It was like, clothes and fashion-wise, like, he is Jeff Winger. Joel McHale has become that character.
He's inhabited it, or maybe the character was just him all along.
Later, we were sitting next to each other in the galley, drinking a beer near each other. I'm still, like, pouring sweat at this point.
What beer did you get?
I had a Reuben's IPA.
Okay.
And I don't know what Joel McHale got. I think he might have gotten... I think it might have been, like, a Space Dust. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. And so we're both sitting there alone, right? He's looking at his Apple Watch. He's scrolling through things on his Apple Watch. And I'm like, what do I say to Joel McHale? And I'm like, okay, here it is. And I'm like, okay, when I leave, I'm going to finish this beer, walk out, and I'm going to fist bump him and be like, go dogs to Joel McHale. And then he finishes beer way before me and left.
What a terrific end of that story. And then had a great tweet on Saturday about how the Huskies were going to beat USC so badly that Lori Loughlin was going to wish she had paid to get her kids into UW.
That's what I thought. Maybe he was going to be the Husky legend on Saturday.
I don't know if he's done that before.
He's just a real fan. He's just out there tweeting about the Huskies, much like we are.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, now let's get to sports. We start with our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci wants basketball back in Seattle. And so do we.
All right. So do you want to talk about media day here?
Sure.
I went to the Blazers media day. It was my first NBA media day since 2007, the last time the Sonics had one.
Wow. You really have never gone to Blazers media day?
No, I've never really had much reason to go down.
And now Zach Collins. Oh, Anfernee Simons.
I mean, a lot of Anfernee Simons.
I understand.
Neil Olshey called him the most talented player he's ever drafted, I think. Which he drafted Dame Earshot. I mean, I feel like when you give the Dame the Supermax extension, what will be the largest contract, one of the largest contracts in NBA history?
Still.
You know, you don't have to suck up to see Dame anymore.
Wow, was Myers Leonard there?
Myers Leonard sadly was not there. In a great tragedy of Blazers Media Day. He was there R.I.P. in our hearts. Yeah, I would say that, normally I don't have a lot of reason to go down there, but since the Blazers are coming off the conference finals, ESPN wanted me to write a news story, and I did, about Damian Lillard saying that, you know, their focus is on winning the championship. Both Terry Stotts and Neil Walshay said...
The rap championship.
I mean, he's already won that, apparently. Okay. Both Stotts and Neil Walshay said that they thought this year's team could be better than last year's, which would be a remarkable feat. Lillard also said the least of his concerns is the statistical projections that have the Blazers out of the playoffs or on the fringes of the playoffs.
And whose statistical projections would those be? I mean,
it was 538 that got cited. It was not my projections.
There you go.
You
would have been in the crosshairs if Durant was there.
Yeah. Did not plan on bringing that one up. Mario Hezonja is going to be quite a treat to have him on the Blazers this year.
Mario
Hezonja's
on the Blazers.
He's on the Blazers, yeah.
Huh. You learn something new every day.
I thought it was funny. Famously, when he played for Barcelona, which he raved about his experience at Barcelona during the media day interview, he was asked, are you going to go see Messi? And he was like, Messi should come see me. But here on Monday, he said that he was planning to go to a Timbers game because he knows someone with the organization. So there you go. Messi, no. Timbers, yes. Thought that was amusing. Pau Gasol's Blazer. I don't know if you like have really processed that.
I like it.
He was kind of the strangest person, I think, to see in a Blazers uniform of all the new players.
Okay.
Another strong quote, though. So, you know, I mean, he's so polished at this stage of his career. What else was
so
the media
your day? Projections? These are 538 is different than yours. Where would your projections have the Blazers?
Well, they also have them like marginally below 500, but they do in fact have them in eighth in the West.
Yours,
yeah,
below 500.
It's like 40.9 wins on
you
average.
Should just rename your projections the Blazer Hating Projections.
I mean, the funny thing,
that's what they do every year.
I mean, the funny thing is that like 4 years ago when they traded everybody and like lost everybody, and then you know people thought they were tanking. Then the projections had them as like a really solid team. They still dramatically beat that projection to, I think that was the year they won and they beat the Clippers in the first round of the playoffs. But like they were way higher on than anyone else.
Sometimes there's glitches in the computer.
Sometimes there are glitches in the computer, and the Blazers have consistently outperformed because guys have come in and played better.
Anthony Simons. There's no way to project greatness.
I mean, I think you probably can project greatness. It's hard to project greatness from a guy who played like 3 minutes a game last year. Oh, and actually, that was my favorite part, is I asked Anthony Simons about the final game of last year's regular season where they beat Sacramento, mm-hmm. and it changed where they got seated in the playoffs. And he was, I got to pull up the exact quote because it's so delightful. He like downplayed it for a bit, and then he comes in with this amazing quote at the end. I retweeted it, so I guess I can find it on my own profile now, can't I?
This is the portion where Kevin reads his own Twitter.
It is. One of my favorite portions of the podcast. Anthony Simon, retweeting my buddy Eric Gunderson, Anthony Simon sheepishly says, there is some truth to him changing the trajectory of the NBA with that game.
That's like you being like, I played a part in Jack Sigma going to the Hall of Fame.
Not
that's
exactly.
Anthony Simons being like,
it's like me saying, it's like me saying, look, you know, no, I don't think I had anything to do with it, but other people are saying I had something to do with it. There's some truth to that. Yeah. And that was terrific.
When does the Blazers season officially start? I guess suppose the whole NBA too.
You know, you only think about it as the Blazers. Well, by the way, as we record this, they have a preseason game 1 week from tonight against the Denver Nuggets.
I thought you were going to say today, and I was going to be like, they don't.
1 week from Tuesday night, as we record this, they play the Denver Nuggets in what should be Michael Porter Jr.'s first NBA action, assuming he's healthy.
So next week, wait, the season doesn't start till a couple weeks.
October 23rd is Blazers opening night against those same Denver Nuggets.
Wow. We are forever linked to the Nuggets. Yep. Are we going to get players to watch for the 2019-20 NBA season? And how many Hernan Gomez's are going to be on it?
I don't know. I feel like the Hernan Gomez's are too experienced now. They've graduated off the list. You got to sneak at least one of them. I don't think there even was an Hernan Gomez last year, because I definitely did Monte Morris for the Nuggets.
Oh, you love Monte Morris.
Oh, love a Monte Morris.
So there's going to be, I mean, Michael Porter Jr. is going to be on the list.
No, he's too prominent.
Is he?
Yeah.
There has to be some sort of Nuggets, like 6'6 wing, who's kind of a good three-point shooter and a pretty good defender.
I mean, Malik Beasley maybe, but like these guys are already, they played important the roles Nuggets in last year's playoff series. Okay, yeah, go come up with some. They signed a European guy this year. Yeah, it did. I thought about it. I mean, he's not going to play this year, but you know, tradition is tradition. But of course, the listener could not hear the shocked, chagrined look on my face when you asked whether that was going to happen. That is a Peltoncast tradition.
There we go. You know, we skipped out on doing songs of the summer.
We did. You want to do that right now?
No.
Okay.
I'm not prepared to do that. I'm just noting.
Weirdly, I selected.
I'm just saying. Peltoncast traditions can be lost.
I guess that's true. I selected The Motion by Drake as the song of the summer, despite the fact that it came out in like 2014, but it came back on Care Package and it was the song of the summer.
Year? Songs of the year and songs of the summer are almost never from the year.
Oh, yeah. Again, the rules are meant to be broken. The other thing we wanted to mention while we're talking about the upcoming NBA season is that the listener Noah Cohen, who was the third Pelton brother earlier this summer, has put together a Peltoncast fantasy basketball league. So if you want to be part of that...
Do I have to do this?
I don't know if I'm doing it.
Oh, okay.
So I guess that leaves you by default. If you want to be a part of that, I'll tweet the link tomorrow, and we'll have it then on the post note on Sonic Central.
I've never played fantasy basketball before.
I haven't played in many, many years. The irony of me being someone who obsessively tracks the NBA, it's literally my job. Fantasy basketball is way too tedious for me.
I don't need to lose at any more fantasy sports.
Wow. Fantasy genius being humbled. Humbled. What's your combined team's combined record right now?
Don't worry about it. I actually don't know. It's not good.
My teams are 8-4, although both the Peltoncast League teams dropped to 500 last week. I lost to Ben B. That
my team's combined record is sub Cliff Kingsbury at Texas Tech.
Oh, no.
So
what you're saying is you're going to get an NFL head coaching job.
I'm going to crush this Peltoncast Fantasy Basketball League.
On the NHL to Seattle front, the NHL Seattle group was officially approved for an AHL affiliate in Palm Springs on Monday.
They love hockey in Palm Springs.
They're barely going to. CEO Todd Leiwicki, I thought this was the most interesting part of that press conference, is that CEO Todd Leiwicki said that the team could potentially hold their training camp at the practice facility and arena that they'll construct in Palm Springs to be ready for the fall of 2021.
They could have a pretty sweet spot to stay at during Coachella.
I guess that's true. All right, let's move on to the Sounders, who got a crucial 1-0 win on Sunday against the San Jose Earthquakes, a match that was scoreless until the very late stages when Jordan Morris scored off of a San Jose defensive miscue to give the Sounders the 1-0 road win and propel them into a tie for second place in the Western Conference, entering Sunday's decision day when they will be facing the team with which they are tied for second, Minnesota United. So second place is on the line in that match, as every MLS team will play at 1 p.m. on Pacific time on Sunday.
Wow. Is this in Seattle?
This is in Seattle.
Oh, come on.
So the Sounders looking really good. So they go second with a win. Otherwise, because Minnesota wins any tie between the two teams, they have more wins over the course of the season. The Sounders have more draws to have the same number of points. So if the two teams draw, the Sounders would finish.
How are the Sounders technically in second then?
They're tied for it. Okay, but Minnesota wins the tie.
So Minnesota is like ahead of them by tiebreakers.
Yes. They're 2B, I guess, if you want to go with that. So if they... two teams draw on Sunday, the Sounders would finish either third or fourth, depending on whether the LA Galaxy win at Houston. And if they lose, they could finish anywhere from third through fifth, depending on the results of that match and the one for Real Salt Lake at Vancouver. Both the Galaxy and Real Salt Lake must win to push the Sounders down to fifth. Now, as a refresher for everyone on the new MLS playoff format, because of the fact that LAFC has long since clinched the one bye in the Western Conference, the Sounders will play in the first round no matter what. If they're seeded second through fourth, they will host that game. Only if they drop down to fifth will they go on the road for that one game in playoff now. It's no longer the two-leg home-and-home playoffs. Getting the second seed is crucially important because then you would host potentially the next round of the playoffs, and either the second or third seed is important because that way you avoid LAFC in the semifinals.
Just win.
Yeah.
That's it.
All right. Thanks, Al Davis. The Sounders on Sunday, both teams were down to 10 players by the end of that match. Javier Arriaga was sent off for the second time in as many games he played with two yellow cards. So he'll be suspended for Sunday's regular season finale. Roman Torres, who came back from suspension, played off the bench in this match and presumably will step in for...
Clean sheet in Roman Torres' first match.
I mean, he didn't play that much. But yes, presumably he'll fill in for Arriaga on Sunday. The Sounders were comfortably dominated in expected goals. It seems like the right result, quote-unquote, in terms of expected goals has not happened in a Sounders match in like 2 months. So I don't know what that tells us about expected goals or just the randomness of soccer.
Yeah, I wouldn't stress too much on expected goals there.
The Sounders and Minnesota United in their other matchup drew 1-1 in St. Paul back in May. Minnesota United has a plus 10 goal differential, second best in the West after LAFC. The Sounders, by contrast, are tied for fourth at plus 2. So, Minnesota, the better of these two teams
over
the course of the season.
Don't worry about it, it's what their expected
goals. But home field will be a crucial edge for the Sounders in this one. As we mentioned at the top of the show, in the toasts, Lorain FC clinched a playoff berth with the win, their third of the season in the Portland Derby. They have not allowed a goal to the Thorns all season. Could still potentially move up to third with a win on decision day if the Thorns lose their finale, but most likely headed for the fourth seed in the playoffs. Megan Rapinoe played basically the full match for the Rain, coming off in stoppage time. Now, the NWSL decision day is not, in fact, next Sunday.
You're going to want to sneak an international break here.
You got to have some victory tour action. The never-ending victory tour continues with matches Thursday and Sunday versus Korea before the NWSL season resumes.
You got to sneak a home-and-home in with Korea.
On October 12th. It's not a home-and-home. They're not flying to Korea. No, they're both here.
Yeah, it's a home-and-home.
No, a home and home means you play each team hosts one of those games.
It means that they're home and then they're home.
No, that is not what it means. Oh, the listener is getting bad information here.
So are all of these Rain FC matches sold out?
I don't know about the upcoming matches.
What day is that final match? Are we going to go to a Rain FC game?
Sunday, October 12th. We will not be going to that match. We will be in San Francisco.
But think of the burritos.
I'm not even 100% sure. They're not at home either. The match is also being played in Orlando. Another impediment to going to that match.
But Rain FC playoffs.
Potentially.
Okay. We got to get down there. Right?
Long ways down there to Tacoma, but I did mention to you earlier how heartened I was by seeing that the listener posted about an excited tweet about the Sounders, I keep saying Rain FC clinching a playoff berth and credited. I get it. That's at the Infragable Joe on Twitter. Shout out to at K Pelton and at Tristan Carcino, really just the at Pelton cast in general, for subconsciously steering me towards Seattle professional women's sports team fandom.
There we go.
No, you were supposed to come in with something else there.
What was I supposed to say?
Full page ad. You're welcome.
We're just steering you to winners.
Exactly.
And that a home and home is two home games.
So he has been to a couple of Wild matches.
Really?
Yeah.
Does he live in Tacoma?
I don't know.
I thought he lived in New York.
I mean, his location on Twitter is "In Your Head by Zombie," so that doesn't really shed any light on it.
Well, anyway, we got to get down to Tacoma and go to a match. I feel like the atmosphere is going to be great. Really packing all these matches as far as we've heard.
I'm not sure about the last couple. You know, certainly the first couple after the World Cup. But and now that Rapinoe is playing again,
back.
You'd think the rain have been quite good.
And we're talking about seeing one of the best soccer players in the entire world right in our backyard, and driving to Tacoma's too fucking far for you.
Wow, you pulled. Okay, yeah. I mean, first off, some of us did go see Rapinoe occasionally when
you
they
drove
were playing.
To Everett routinely to see the Storm.
Yeah, that's true.
And Everett's a lot farther than Tacoma.
From where we live, yes.
As the crow flies.
I don't think it is farther from downtown Seattle as the crow flies, but I'm not sure of that off the top of my head.
Don't worry about the crow.
Okay.
Anyway, we have got to get down to Tacoma.
All right. Hopefully there's not any in international break, any victory tour games in between that pushes it into the NBA regular season. That would certainly make it impossible.
If I can quote Lil B, the base god, Tacoma, Washington for life!
Wow. Okay, we're feuding with Burien. We were feuding with Burien, but not feuding with Tacoma.
Feud over with Burien.
Feud is over with Burien. Should we turn our attention to UW football? Coming off a 28-14 win over number 21 USC, moving up to 15th in the AP poll, 16th in the coaches poll, heading into Saturday's game at Stanford. A Pac-12 after dark matchup. There's going to be a couple of these in a row. Kicking off at 7:30.
A couple in a row?
Yeah, you saw the Arizona game time, didn't you?
Also 7:30?
8 p.m. On that one.
Okay.
There you go. So, takeaways from Saturday's game. The number one thing is, our seats in the East End Zone, we've talked about a lot. In front of us, a couple rows in front of us during this game, gotta get out of soccer mode, we start to see people wearing number 26 jerseys, one of which says his cousin, and another says Showtime. It's like, clearly these are customized jerseys. This has to be Savon Ahmed's family, unless there's like a number 26 on defense that we do not remember whose nickname is Showtime. And then eventually more 26 jerseys filter in, his sister and just mom. And it becomes clear from their cheering that they are in fact Savon Ahmed's family. And it was a great game to sit behind Savon Ahmed's family, because after sitting out the Utah game to, you know, get right physically, he rips off an 89-yard touchdown, the longest by a Husky since Napoleon Kaufman in 1994, which, by the way, that was 25 years ago.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, we're old.
Whew. That was actually very cool to see with his family right there.
It was an incredible moment. Like we were going to be very excited about an 89-yard Savon Ahmed touchdown either way, but extra excited for the benefit of his family.
Hometown listed as Kirkland, Washington. I thought we might get a Tacoma, Washington for life.
No, sadly, no. Not on that one.
Oh, well. Shouts to the Rose Hill location of Taco Time.
Newly opened, right? Oh, no, not that one. That was a different one. I thought the second thing worth talking about, Christian Capable wrote a great piece about this on The Athletic Seattle.
Love that nickname for him, though. Christian Capable. It sounds like...
It's like a Disney show.
Or like a children's like series.
Yeah, it's like Kim Possible. It's Christian Capable.
Christian Capable. Well, I'm imagining like a book series. He's like a mouse with a fedora.
What?
He's Christian Capable.
I don't know why he's a mouse with a fedora.
That's
though.
What he is.
Okay. Anyways,
Christian Capable.
He was capable of writing a great story about the coverage the Huskies employed on this. They went to kind of bracket coverage on USC's wide receivers, who we talked about is a real dangerous aspect of this Trojans team, particularly Michael Pittman Jr. with the combination of size and athleticism, and often played a dime defense with four corners out there and stacked basically both of them opposite the two wide receivers so that one was kind of playing press cover two style defense, and then the other was picking anything deep. And it worked. I mean, Matt Fink making...
Pete Carroll's rolling in his grave with that coverage.
Matt Fink making his first road start averaged just 5.1 yards per attempt in this one with three interceptions.
I mean, we saw the week before, anybody who was watching that USC game versus Utah, there wasn't a lot to the USC offense and the things that worked. It was these two wide receivers get wide open. Matt Fink throws up the ball to them.
I mean, I don't think that was all of what they did, but that was the most dangerous thing they did.
And take away the most dangerous thing. Deep passes are both from a defense perspective and an offense perspective. Stopping them is one of the most important things that you can do. And having them is one of the most important things that you can do. Like, this is more important, deep passes, 30, 40 yards.
Now thanks, Pete Carroll.
It's true, though. Like,
no, it's not
untrue. You can dink and dunk all you want. You're basically waiting around for somebody to make a mistake or kick a field goal. But a deep pass leads to a touchdown a lot.
Which is a strategy the Huskies often employ. They're typically one of the lowest in the nation in terms of yards per completion and will allow them a higher completion percentage. But this kind of took it to its logical extreme where... Basically, I mean,
they're facing some of the best wide receivers they've maybe ever faced.
Yeah.
And a team that is so singularly focused on getting the ball to those wide receivers that you can give up some yardage on the ground.
So they basically only had one mistake in this coverage, which was a play where Cam Williams seemed to be late getting back into providing help. And Michael Pittman Jr. did
true
come up with a 44-yard touchdown on that one.
Like, you could be in your third year in the NFL and still have blown coverage as a safety.
For sure. It was an interesting day for Cam Williams, who also was largely to blame, I think, on the long touchdown run. Or it wasn't a touchdown run. He was stopped short of the goal line.
But took, like, a really bad angle.
It was an unfortunate angle. But then also comes up in this game with a pair of interceptions, including the one that effectively sealed the game.
I mean, I think Cam Williams, as a true freshman starting on this defense, he's going to grow into a real player.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to be talking about Cam Williams as a legendary Huskies secondary player for this era.
I think one of the big takeaways from last week, above and beyond just the coverage that they played, is, the secondary continuing to come together. Trent McDuffie has done a nice job stepping in for Kyler Gordon. Gordon still saw action in this one when they went to that dime defense, and that, I think, really played to his strengths in terms of pressing at the line of scrimmage, but not necessarily needing to play the ball in the air, which has been a weakness for him.
Kyler Gordon is a nickel corner, and that's not a bad thing. Not everybody needs to be an outside corner.
You know when it's a bad thing?
When?
When you've got Elijah Molden just destroying in that role.
It's tough.
Coming up with an interception in this one as well.
They have two very good inside corners, and they have two very good outside corners.
The other thing Kyler Gordon did in this game, some amazing contributions on special teams covering punts. Downing one inside the 5-yard line, and then also one play where he just comes flying down to make the tackle immediately.
Is Molden a senior?
No. He's like a sophomore.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's a really young secondary.
But so the last time that we just on Cam Williams, the last time we saw a true freshman.
Oh, he's a junior. I'm sorry.
Freshman playing this much in the secondary was Taylor Rapp.
Well, there's also true. I guess actually none of the guys. Yeah.
Not a redshirt freshman.
Yeah, that's probably true.
And I think that's what we're going to be talking about. I mean, making these types of plays huge against a team. I mean, to quote you after the game, the Huskies did a thing. Right? They beat a ranked team. They beat USC. It's not an easy thing to do. And Cam Williams making plays in that game is huge.
I thought people were a little too down on this game overall. Like, there was a lot of talk about USC's mistakes and the fact that the Huskies made their own mistakes and didn't necessarily pay for them, including, I think that interception was to stop the drive where, initially UW had turned it over on a trick play, a fumble there, and then USC got a bunch of penalties that backed them up, so it wasn't a huge hit in terms of field position, and it doesn't ultimately cost them any points, but did make things a little more stressful than they could have been. But
it was an arm's length game.
Yes.
I mean, USC is probably, recruiting-wise, the most talented team that they will play all year.
We'll see.
That's not a C thing. It isn't.
If they play in a bowl game.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah. Yes. I mean, depending on who they're playing in the bowl game. As far as a team that is on the schedule in the Pac-12, USC still recruits like an elite program.
Although some other teams are starting to recruit like an elite program. We'll get to that in a second. I thought you were going to continue there. Was that all you had to say? Yeah, I mean, look, USC has beaten some really good teams this season.
They beat really good team this season. We're including Stanford in that mix?
Yeah, no, I guess we're not. Okay. Yeah, they've been a really good team. Utah, which bounced back. You had some hot takes about the Utah defense that did not look great after their performance against Wazoo on Saturday.
My takes moved. They just move around the Pac-12. Whatever you mentioned that the what's the term for it?
Oh, the when when you play like the transitive property.
Yeah, the transitive property for the Pac-12 is just a wheel. That's the same with my takes. They just move around from team to team. Whatever team is currently getting destroyed, that team sucks. So the takes have moved to Wazoo sucks. And really...
Well, Mike Leach agrees with those takes.
I want to talk about the air raid later, but I want to talk about the air raid and motion offense later.
Oh, you've got some air raid takes. Not the finest day, certainly, for Jacob Eason coming off that dominant performance at BYU. Goes 16 of 26 for 180 yards, 6.9 yards per attempt, and a 42.4 QBR in this one.
I was impressed with USC's defense in this game.
Yeah, which had not... You know, their pass defense, as we mentioned, had generally been better than their rush defense, and that's how it played out in this one.
And they played fairly well against Utah, also.
The Huskies ran for 5.5 yards per carry, just kind of... Augment 9 yards per carry is the lead back here.
This is a Jake Browning game.
Yeah. And Jake Browning generally was better than this. Maybe not against USC necessarily.
No.
The last bit of news here is alluded to earlier. The Huskies on Friday getting a huge commitment from Kennedy Catholic outside linebacker Savelle Smalls. And this we probably ought to test it.
Oh! There is a Lancer in the building.
Two of them, when you count Sam Heward, who is already committed for 2021. Smalls ranked number 10 in the ESPN Recruiting Nation 300, the highest ranked UW commit in the Recruiting Nation era, which goes back to 2006. Oh, and in that period had been Shaq Thompson, who was ranked 16th. If you go by 24/7 Sports, which goes all the way back to 2000, Smalls at number 9 overall there is number 3 among all UW recruits, and that's in the 2000s behind Thompson, who's higher there, and Reggie Williams.
Both of whom turn out to be top 15 picks? Or did Shaq go a little bit later?
I can't remember exactly where he was picked. But yeah.
First round draft picks.
Yeah.
And you can look through these recruiting rankings and see so many players who never even played in the NFL.
Yes.
And the fact that these players have... both the players before who preceded him as extremely highly recruited players or highly ranked players, both of them going to the NFL and being impact players in the NFL is huge. I mean, I was looking at Shaq Thompson this last weekend, and it's like, he's just a good NFL player.
Yeah.
That's it. He's not a superstar. He's just a good NFL player. He's always there. And if Savelle Smalls is anywhere near what Shaq Thompson was at UW, it is going to be huge for the program.
It's interesting. He also fills a clear need. Like, their pass rush has not been a strength, I would say, of this year's team.
I mean, as a freshman, yes, I suppose. But, like, we have to be projecting beyond that.
He's going
to
play as a freshman.
Yes, he will play as a freshman. But what I'm saying is that Savelle Smalls, it's not necessarily about his freshman year or whatever.
It's about as soon as Sam Heward gets there so that they can together lead the Huskies to a championship.
But it's
as
also
said.
About building this program to the point that there, and this is what Chris Peterson has done, that there isn't any sort of drop off, right? There's no one year where you're like, okay, that's the extreme down year. We have all of these good players and then they're gone, right? It's about having consistency and just getting more and more and more and more talent in the program, right?
Yeah,
and that's what Savelle Smalls is we're talking about into this program where Chris Peterson is constantly putting players in the NFL alongside Jimmy Lake and Pete Kwiatkowski, right? He's putting players in the NFL every single year. And now, if he's able to recruit at this extremely high level, you start having a conversation where the program looks a little bit more like the powers of all of college football, not just the Pac-12.
So the addition of Smalls moved UW's class for 2020 up to 12th overall on 24/7 Sports. Haven't yet gotten an update from ESPN Recruiting Nation.
I mean, we talked about this right when Chris Peterson came to UW, and it's really borne out also. Like, he's recruiting better already than he did at Boise State. And at Boise State, he was the winningest coach in all of college football history. And as he's able to sort of show success consistently, he's able to continue recruiting. It's always going to be more difficult in the Northwest than it will be in a place like Los Angeles or in the Southeast, right? But if he can keep these players at home, and there's a lot of talent coming through Washington and the Northwest, you know, the Huskies are talking about building a long-term program.
But they're going out and getting guys, too, that were pieces, both Christian Capable and I believe it was Mike Varell in the Seattle Times had pieces this week about how UW is recruiting on much more even terms with USC. If you look at the numbers in terms of, you know, the number of guys with USC offers who have chosen UW in the last couple of years versus the number of players with UW offers who have chosen USC.
So you're saying if you could play for the winningest coach in college football history, or you could play for Clay Helton?
Well,
some players are making choices.
I mean, the downside is we'll see how long Clay Helton is at USC after this performance.
Yes.
That's the downside of being in USC. A team that has not, you know, been able to avoid that down year.
Let's be careful. But anyway, I know where you're going with
this. They're currently in the process of that down year. The Stanford Cardinal.
That's future Seahawks head coach David Shaw to you.
So I got to say, I got egg on my face here. I thought Stanford was going to win the Pac-12, or at least win the Pac-12 North, because the schedule set up so favorably for them. They hosted both UW, they will host UW, and hosted Oregon. And it seemed like, you know, I looked at the history of when they've had that, which happens every other year, Stanford has typically won the Pac-12 North and gone to the Pac-12 championship game. They were bringing back KJ Costello, who was the top-ranked quarterback in the Pac-12 last year by QBR, and you just figured they'd keep it rolling, as they always do. And instead, that has not happened. On Saturday, Stanford got a 31-28 win over at Oregon State on a Jet Toner field goal.
God, I can't believe Jet Toner is still there.
Big Jet Toner fan.
Jet Toner is forever.
Another family I saw when they were in the Stanford bar, or the hotel across from the Stanford
the Toner
campus.
You've been around the Ahmed and the Toner family this week?
Yeah, not wow. This week. That was a year ago when I was at Nate Duncan's wedding. When I was in Palo Alto. Wow.
Name dropping again.
Yeah.
But I didn't tell a whole story about seeing Joel McHale.
So that was after the Beavers had erased a 28-14 fourth quarter lead, and it snapped the three-game losing streak that they had after winning their opener against Northwestern. Backup quarterback Davis Mills made his second start in place of KJ Costello, who sat out with a right thumb injury and went 18 of 25 for 245 yards and three touchdowns against the Oregon State defense. David Shaw said Tuesday that Costello is, quote, somewhere between questionable and doubtful. Play this week
in the most college football way of describing things.
I don't know. I think that's a fair one, because he's just thinking probabilistically. Like, probable is 50, or doubtful is 25%, questionable is 50%.
I think doubtful is lower than 25%.
Well, according to the traditional NFL definitions of it. So he's sitting at a solid, like, 35% chance to play this week.
Somewhere between
37.5. 40, somewhere in that range.
That's the most information about an injury, though, that we've gotten from the Pac-12 in like 6 years.
It really is. So Costello was decent in their opener in Northwestern. He wasn't good, but he left that game with an apparent head injury that forced him to miss the loss to USC. And since he came back, Costello has been awful. Combined in losses to Central Florida and Oregon, he went 37 of 74 for 319 yards, one touchdown, and two interception. That's 4.3 yards per attempt in that. His QBR has declined from last year's Pac-12 leading 82.6 mark, almost in half,
wow,
to 46.4 so far this season, which ranks 11th among qualifying Pac-12
quarterbacks. And Davis Mills is somewhere between probable and questionable with regards to QBR.
Yes, at 61.5. But you know what? That doesn't count.
What doesn't that count?
Davis Mills had an amazing catch in traffic for a touchdown on Saturday.
QBR doesn't count that at all?
I don't believe
I'm
it
supposed
does.
To trust this stat?
Yeah, they count rushing, but not receiving. They ran the Stanford special, as he called it.
Oh, God. I'm so sick of plays being called that.
The thing was, the play didn't work at all. Oregon State had two defenders on Davis Mills, and he just went up and elevated in traffic and high-pointed the ball. It was an incredible catch. Like, Davis Mills maybe should be played wide receiver for them.
Yeah, he's just putting some stuff on tape.
If right KJ now. Costello is back at quarterback, like, look out for Davis Mills. The rushing game has not been there for Stanford without Bryce Love. They're 3.6 yards per carry, rank 100th in the NCAA. Their starter Cameron Scarlett is at 4.4 yards per carry, similar to what he did last year, filling in for Love when he was injured. The real surprise for me, I mean, like, I get that Costello has been hurt.
Yes.
And that's substantially changed.
I was just going to say this.
I get that Bryce Love is not walking through that door. Their defense has dropped from 37th in FPI efficiency to last year to 86th this season. And that I do not get at all. I don't know what
it's shocking, right? I mean, when you look at a Stanford team, you assume no matter how much turnover there is, and really, can you think of players who've gone to the NFL from Stanford on defense in the last?
I'm sure there are. They exist. I can't think of them off the top of my
head. But there's no like first, second, third round draft picks, right, that we're thinking of?
There probably are some. I don't know.
Seeing a Stanford defense be rated 86 is shocking.
Yeah.
And it's so un-Stanford like.
Very much so.
It's like their offense not playing well. Whatever, we're used to that. We get that. That's not what Stanford is necessarily built around. But having a defense that can't stop teams, that's giving up 28 points to Oregon State, that's barely winning that game. This is not Stanford football.
So last year they had linebacker Bobby Okereke drafted in the third round by the Colts. Of course, if you go back to 2017, Solomon Thomas was the third pick of the draft. You may recall that. And then
what is he doing now, man?
Justin Reed, I believe that's Eric Reed's brother, I'm pretty sure, was drafted in the third round in 2018.
I had no idea Eric Reed had a brother until they were mentioning it in that game on Sunday.
Yes. Same here. So there you go.
But I mean, the Huskies have had similar talent drafted.
A lot more.
Well, a lot more similar. I mean, like, yes, Solomon Thomas. Is he good?
He's solid, I think.
Cool.
Yeah. Part of a dominating 49ers defense. They are. You had nothing else there? The Stanford defense is allowing opponents to complete 70.6% of their passes, which ranks 127th of the 130 NCAA FCS teams FBS teams, and they are 126th out of 30 in opponent yards per attempt at 9.4. So this could be a big game for Jacob Eason.
My God.
Guess what I'm trying to say here.
Still, just a shocking thing to see for Stanford. And I mean, the Huskies are a well-rounded offense. They rank number 13 in the country. They're able to beat anything, right? Like, that's what we've seen in the last couple of weeks. We have the monster game from Jacob Eason 2 weeks ago at BYU. We have the monster game from Savon Ahmed last week. You know, there's really no defense that you can sort of hone in on something. Everything could be available to them. This might be more of an Eason day.
I think so. The last note on Stanford that I had is that Sumner product Connor Weddington, who I believe played with our cousin Kyle in high school,
Kyle's on the JV team.
Leads the Pac-12 with 30 yards per kick return.
Just so a watch heads out for up, there. There's still time to snowboard back home to UW. I know you're having a great time there at Stanford, where they probably do have mountains, right?
I mean, you can get to them, yes. You can get to mountains.
There's still time to transfer, Connor, if you want to come and play for a winner.
Should we do chances of victory here? The Huskies are 16-point favorites in this game, which is amazing. This is a game that
16-point favorites?
I think at the beginning of
that
the
season. That is too much.
It is too much. They didn't even beat Oregon by 16 points. The final of that was 21-6.
Oregon didn't even beat Stanford by 16 points.
Yes, that's what I mean to say, yes.
No. Oh, I'm...
You are shocked.
There's just...
I mean, this was my reaction, too. I've already gone through it.
There, I'm... Right? Jim Croce told us.
Wait,
the
did
things,
we mention,
the
by the way?
Things you don't do.
Did
right?
we mention, by the way, that the Huskies' last win at Stanford came November 3rd, 2007? They have lost their last five trips there.
It does feel a bit like, I'm going to knock on wood while I say this, that the already limp Stanford crowd may have given up on the season.
Yeah, that seems very possible. I don't doubt that.
The home field advantage is not going to be strong.
It rarely is, and yet, five-game losing streak there.
Stanford was a better team all five of those games.
I was hoping that it was still the Walt Harris era when the Huskies last win.
Was there a year that Stanford beat UW in Stanford that UW was a better team than them?
2 years ago, the Huskies were probably a better team, weren't they?
Yeah,
they went
were.
To the Fiesta
yeah,
Bowl. Yeah.
Bryce Love game.
But sadly, by the way, the 2007 game, that was Jim Harbaugh's first season on the farm.
Great. Was that the game? That was the game that Toby Gearhart went crazy?
No.
That was
they lost that
ago.
Game. That was 2009.
That was 2009?
Yeah.
Where the Huskies had just beaten USC. We were all fired up about beating USC. And then we went into Stanford the next week and they killed us.
Well, yeah, 2007, as I've said, that was the last time they won a game there.
Oh, the Huskies won in 2007.
So
okay.
By definition.
So 2009 was the game.
Yes.
That I'm thinking of. Okay. You just, like I said, you don't
Gearhart,
have a team of 16-point favorites in Stanford.
Gearhart had 27 carries for 200 yards in that game.
Jeez. He got on the cover of Madden that day.
And Andrew Luck had 8 carries for 59 yards. Yes, he was there.
I didn't realize Luck
he was
there.
I think he was okay. A freshman at that point.
We didn't know Andrew Luck was Andrew Luck.
Wait, do you think that Toby Gearhart was on the cover of Madden?
Oh, no, that wasn't Toby Gearhart. That was Peyton Hillis.
Yeah. Not all white running backs are the same, sir.
They all look the same to me.
Do you think Sean McGrew was on the cover of that?
He's off-white, I'm telling you. I think it's a 73% chance of winning.
By the way, Andrew Luck in that game threw 14 passes. They ran...
I hate Stanford.
49 times. What an amazing Jim Harbaugh game. And Jake Locker delivered a classic 16 of 31 for 191 yards and 2 interceptions.
On his way to the 8th pick in the draft right there.
Oh, boy.
Jake Locker solidified the 8th pick in the draft.
We should really look through old box scores much more frequently on this
let's
pod.
Let's not do that. I think that they have a 73% chance of winning. 16 points is way too many. I refuse to accept that in a game where the Huskies are playing at Stanford.
I'm still going 80%.
Have fun with that.
That is contingent, by the way, on Davis Mills playing. Like, if KJ Costello plays, honestly, it's higher at this point. They should be playing Davis Mills either way. I'm a huge KJ Costello fan,
no,
but he's hurt.
Nope. Have a healthy amount of fear of Stanford.
Okay.
I mean, I'm the one who said that I thought that the Huskies would go undefeated from here on out in the Pac-12, but I still have a healthy amount of fear. I hear 8 p.m. in Arizona, and I say to myself, that ain't good, right?
If Khalil Tate plays, he'll be doing crazy things after dark.
Oh, man. You don't only fear Stanford, you also fear Pac-12 after dark.
Accurate.
Just everybody involved, be careful.
I feel appropriate fear here.
Have appropriate fear.
Okay.
Much as the Seahawks had last weekend. Heading into the desert.
No, we got to go back to the 2007 box score.
Oh, gosh.
Jake Locker in that win, the last Husky win at Stanford, 16 of 32 for 151 yards
there
and a
we
touchdown.
Go.
He did have 16 carries for 97 yards and 2 touchdowns.
We
cared
about completion percentage era.
No, we still cared. We still cared then. All right, the Seahawks, yes, had appropriate fear of the Arizona Cardinals and took care of business in a... more than at arm's length, I would say. I don't know what's more than arm's length. 27-10 win over the Cardinals on Sunday.
And just a comfortable win.
Yeah.
Exactly what you would have wanted heading into the desert.
A relatively stress-free game, mm-hmm. I would say.
Even when it was stressful, it wasn't that stressful.
That's fair.
the one thing that I think we need to look at, I think all of Seahawks Twitter got very antsy after the loss to New Orleans last week. And we all said to ourselves, Pete is going to respond to this by running more.
Doubling down.
Than Mike Zimmer could even dream of.
More than Jim Harbaugh at Stanford could dream of.
He was going to...
The numbers spoke for themselves.
He was going to obliterate that box score from 2009, right? That's what we thought. But really, they went into the game, and with their charted first 15 plays, they passed way more than we thought they were going to.
Now, this may be because of the fact that the Arizona secondary, despite the presence of two Huskies in said secondary, and it was...
And it Patrick was, Peterson. It's
is no, it Patrick Peterson bad? Is suspended. He's
okay,
not
he
there.
Was out.
This is not present. The opposite of absent, I guess, is the opposite of present. But they took advantage of that. They were aggressive. There was a lot more of the quick passing, I thought, that we saw in the second half against Pittsburgh, particularly taking advantage of Will Disley up the seam. And Will Disley, the thrill. Tying the most ever touchdowns for a tight end through his first eight games with his sixth. Incredible.
Man. But really, the scripted plays that they ran, even if that's the case, even if the secondary doesn't look good.
No, it's still encouraging. I'm not saying, I just don't know that it's necessarily going to translate going forward.
It was the best they looked all game.
It was the good offense. They kind of, you know, they packed it in a little early in the third quarter, but that was fine. That wasn't terrible. And then
Pete's comment was that he wished they'd run more.
When Arizona did score to get this down to a 2010 game, then they responded with an 8-minute drive, huge plays from Russell Wilson on third down, making magic there, and you know, both took a bunch of time off the clock and got the touchdown that made this a three-score game.
It took almost a quarter off the clock. Well, half a quarter. It took 8 minutes.
Yeah, I wouldn't describe 8 minutes as almost 15. That's some incredible rounding there.
Still, it was a hell of a drive that they put together.
It was an awesome drive.
And really took some big plays from not one L.
Oh, two L's. Two That's L's. Right. Yes.
Luke Wilson. And
the Wilson
to
Wilson connection is back.
Penalty after penalty in the red zone, but seeing CJ punch it in for the touchdown was very cool to see.
Shot out of a cannon on that play. That was exciting. I wanted more CJ Procise in this game with Rashad Penny against City. Especially since, by all accounts, Penny will be back on Thursday. But that was nice to see CJ get into the end zone, get us tacos.
I forgot to get tacos today.
Yeah.
Did you?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I've had a lot of taco time lately. I don't know about you.
We should record a podcast about it.
We should. Chris Carson back to form in this game. 22 carries for 104 yards on the ground and then 4 catches for 41 yards. Including some, you know, big plays in the passing game. Now, maybe not as impressive as it looks when you consider that Arizona is allowing 4.8 yards per carry this season.
It doesn't matter, though. That's the thing.
He held on to the ball. He looked good.
He could have played badly. Playing good against teams that are bad is still an important thing to do.
We haven't mentioned the real highlight of this game, which is Jadeveon Clowney getting to show off as a playmaker with the ball in his hands. The one-handed catch of the pass he tipped at the line of scrimmage, which Kyler Murray might be too short and might have a problem with. I mean, he's not actually too short, but might have a problem with tipped passes because of his height. And then taking it to the house in a play that could only be compared to the eldest baby fantasy genius coming up with a pick six in the day in flag football. As you got your first victory as a flag football coach in your first game.
You know, I've got a lot of people to thank. Is this a victory speech?
Sure.
I ran so much in that game as a coach, I think Pete would be proud.
It's true. It's very different math and flag football.
I was really concerned, I'd have to say. We ran one passing play near the end of the game when we were just salting away the clock. I'm probably the only coach in the history of pick six flag football who huddled up just to run clock. Yeah, and I told my team,
that's
I was like,
too far?
It was pretty fun. I was like, hey, we're just huddling here. I'm running a little bit of clock. There's a running clock right now. There's no play clock. You know, let me know what you want to run here, but we're just taking some time.
My only disappointment was Jamal Crawford wasn't at that field to see your
coaching.
Yeah.
Yeah. I swear to God, like, I can't imagine that another coach had that conversation with their team that day, that they were running clock in the game. It's just,
I don't know if that's a good thing.
You're looking for inefficiencies. That's the reality. You're trying to win the game, and you're looking for inefficiencies, and there's no play clock.
I liked when the
that's an inefficiency.
I liked when the opposing coach told you there was nice misdirection.
Nice misdirection. Thanks, fella. They had that other team, though. Do you see they had like notebooks, right?
I did.
They were like, oh my God, what's his name? The coach of the Giants from a couple years ago. Who had the giant sheet of plays.
What, McAdoo?
Yeah, but they were the Ben McAdoo of coaches.
Well, you were going with the Mike Leach strategy where you only had a few plays, but you were executing them well.
Every team only has a few plays.
Well, you weren't driving up new plays in the huddle each time. Your play was handing off
to the one good kid.
But you weren't like drawing up new plays in the huddle each time, as they apparently were.
No, they had too many plays in the game, but also they had that hotshot offense. They had literally an offensive coach and a defensive coach.
I don't think that was like a coordinator thing. I think that was probably just like, hey, let's split up responsibility.
They had that hotshot kid come out with his playbook, with his his notebooks full of plays, and he came out there and we just shut everything down. So anyway, shouts to the Chargers is what I'm trying to say. 30-10, baby.
Was that the final?
No, that's what they beat the Dolphins by.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And Baby Fantasy Genius was, let's call him Joey Bosa-like.
I don't know if that's what I would said I would go for.
He was not Derwin James Spry.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, the last topic I had was heading into Thursday night, the Seahawks' success in primetime games. They are 26-5-1 under Pete Carroll.
Can you name those NFL. Five losses? No, I don't know.
Okay, at Arizona at home on Sunday Night Football, a game that we've talked about that's entirely the only one that I can too remember. Much in recent memory. That's the only one I can think of off the top of my head. I know the tie.
Yeah, we remember the tie. I really can't remember any of the other losses.
I mean, I probably could if I thought about it, but not right now.
No, they beat Washington on the Monday Night Football game, right?
Well, they lost to Chicago on Monday Night Football last year. So there's one of them.
That was Monday Night Football?
Yeah. I was eating Korean barbecue. It was a great time.
It was not a great time.
Yeah, I'm not really.
And neither of the Rams games that they played, right? They've never played the Rams on...
I mean, they have played the Rams, but not in Sean McVay era.
All of them have been evening games.
Yeah.
Kind of weird that they have not played on a Sunday or Monday night.
It is unusual.
But you look at the Seahawks at home on, I mean, Thursday is a different one. Thursday is a different animal because we haven't seen a lot of Thursday games at home. These have almost always been on the road.
There was the Rams game on Thursday night during the short-lived, whichever fossil era.
That was the one where Goff like threw the pass like 3 yards short, right?
Yes.
Yeah, in his rookie year.
And John Ryan.
And John Fossil's year.
John Ryan had the fake punt for a first down.
That was a fun one. John Stossel?
Yes, that's it.
But you do think back to two seasons ago, the Eagles come here on Monday Night Football and the Seahawks beat them. We have last season, the Chiefs look like one of the best teams in the NFL, and the Seahawks beat them. They lost to the Falcons on a Monday night game. You remember that one? God, that was a brutal loss.
Yep.
That was 2 years ago.
Yep.
But also, you have going into New England on a Sunday night, right? There's so many moments of games where you would sort of approach it like, this is maybe not the most winnable game. And especially in Seattle, just the energy has been electric.
I'm imagining the electricity is going to be pretty good.
You know, we didn't talk about this, but I have to say, at that Saints game, ironically, considering how brutal of a game it was.
You were impressed with the crowd?
It was the best crowd we've seen in years.
So my take that the Seahawks have better home field advantage in Arizona is not actually correct.
It was the crowd in that Saints game was ready to go, and they didn't ever have the opportunity to.
I think the fact that the late Paul Allen is going to be honored before the game, going into the Ring of Honor. His sister Jody, the team's acting chair, is going to raise the 12th man, or the 12th flag, no longer the 12th man flag. I think all of that, the fact that there's probably not a lot of traveling Rams fans compared to a lot of the teams you'd play in primetime probably helps the crowd atmosphere, I would say. Mm-hmm. So this is poised to be a big time. And then coming off last week's win.
Coming off a win, coming off a big loss for the Rams, it's going to be... And they're also just the hated Rams. Like, that's the reality, is right now, the rivals change within a division, but right now the Rams are the number one rival.
That's accurate.
And having this game against that team here with a chance to go 4-1 and knock them down to 3-2, it's going to be a big one.
It sure is.
So tell us about the Rams.
Well, you mentioned their loss last week, and that was a stunning game. I mean, we were, you know, kind of monitoring that one because it was going on opposite the Seahawks game, and you see that Tampa Bay has gone up, what, 21-0 at one point in this game, I think. And then, you know, there was a point in the second half of this one where the Rams had gotten back to within 45-40 after a Marcus Peters pick six, and you're like, here it goes again. You know, they're going to come back in this one because there was still 8 minutes left, but the Tampa Bay gets a field goal on their subsequent drive to make an 8-point game, and then Dominican Sue in a revenge game finishes it off with a 37-yard fumble return for a touchdown. Jared Goff had three interceptions in this game, as many as points the Rams scored in the Super Bowl.
There we go.
And I would say the big question, if the Rams had a diehard fan base in LA, if they weren't only talking about the Dodgers playoffs and the Lakers media day on the radio in LA, people would be talking about what's going on with Jared Goff, who signed this huge extension during training camp.
I don't know if they would say what's going on with Jared Goff, because I don't think anybody ever, aside from the Rams front office, no one ever determined that he was the guy.
Look, come on, Charles Green. What are you doing? Why did you extend him for so much money so early?
There was nobody who was a Rams fan. I'm sure there was somebody. But I'm assuming the general consensus among Rams fans wasn't that Jared Goff is an elite quarterback, right, who needs to be paid. It was, let's see.
I don't know. I don't think there was a lot of positive reaction to Barnwell, like, floating the idea that they should trade him and look for someone else.
Like, three or four people on the internet were upset about it?
Well, the Rams organization was not too thrilled about it. That's for sure.
But
I'm sorry. The Ramley was not too thrilled about it.
So, when you look at this Rams offense in the 2019 season, I mean, they sort of have this reputation, right, as being this, like, forward-thinking, exciting offense. And,
I mean, when you put it in that tone, it sounds like it's not accurate. It is accurate. They are a forward-thinking, exciting offense.
But when you see in DVOA, Seahawks and the Rams, with everything that we know about these two teams, and the Seahawks being a better rated offensive team than the Rams, you ask the question, why?
Well, they've got the better quarterback. That's why.
And really, that's what it boils down to, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Todd Gurley has not gotten the same amount of carries that he's seen in the past.
So we had the report, I think that was Jay Glazer back then, right before the opening game of the season. They were playing a 10 a.m. game at Carolina, that the Rams don't know how Todd Gurley's knee is going to hold up this year. They're just going to throw him out there and see how it goes. And I think that's directly reflected in his workload, the fact that he has just 49 carries through four games and five of them on Sunday when they went behind so early.
And then you have sort of the triple-headed monster wide receivers, right?
Yeah.
You have Brandon Cooks, Robert Woods, and Cooper Kupp. All of them have been good but not great this year.
They've been fine.
They've been a little bit damned sort of by not catching deep passes, especially when you get to the advanced stats. Advanced stats don't love the short pass. They're kind of in the 20 to 30 range DVOA-wise, right? But they're all good, and there's a lot of them.
I mean, I think the greater problem is when they throw to anybody who's not one of those three receivers, including Gurley, who's averaging 3.6 yards per target this season, half of last season's 7.2 yards per target.
Well, and even receiving, I mean, like the Rams, I think they zigged pretty hard while everybody else was zagging with regards to running back receptions. Todd Gurley had 7 catches last week on 11 targets. Before then, he only had 4 catches all season.
Wow.
So they were very focused on getting the ball to those receivers and running with Gurley and Malcolm Brown while they are going to run. But they were not going to pass in the ball, which was something that was fairly successful for them last season.
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily something they've strategically decided to take away. I mean, it may be related to the workload. But fundamentally, the problem is Jared Goff.
Yeah.
He's 26th in QBR at 39.5, down from 63.6, which ranked 10th last season. His completion percentage is basically unchanged, but his yards per completion, you mentioned the lack of deep passes, down from 12.9 the last two seasons, exactly the same mark, to 11.3 this year. And then there's just the turnovers. He's thrown a league-high 6 interceptions, nearly as many as in the entire more than the entire 2017 season when he had 5, and half of last season's total of 12. He's also fumbled in every game so far after a league-high 12 fumbles. We've got to
keep that going.
Last season.
We have to keep that streak going.
How much can you see Jadeveon Clowney forcing a fumble in this game?
Oh, my God. Well, and also, like, we're talking about Ziggy Ansah coming back, Jadeveon getting into the mix.
Ziggy finally got his first sack as a Seahawk on the last play of the game. That was exciting.
Some pressure could be a factor here. So the thing I want to say about the air raid offense, which is not exactly what I would say the Rams run.
They do not run an air raid.
They sort of run like a spread motion offense. And the one thing that can kind of damn those offenses is, and we've seen this, again, like the Cardinals are running more of an air raid or whatever, but these offenses that sort of want to pass the ball and get the ball into space is there's a little bit of a tendency to dink and dunk, right? I mean, we saw it on Saturday with Wazoo. Like, Anthony Gordon completed a lot of passes, but for not a lot of yards and not a lot of yards per attempt. And that is the one thing that you need to avoid. And our man's Bruce Arians avoids that. But Bruce Arians says we are going to get the goddamn ball downfield. But it's a thing.
And you know who else says that?
Who's that?
To his credit, even though it shouldn't take away from the quick passing game, Pete Carroll has also been known to say that a time or two.
If I knew a man who can do both.
Is that a pro Bruce Arians? Like, you want to bring the Kegel hat to Seattle full time? I mean, he does have a great record at CenturyLink Field.
I would love it. But I do think that this type of
offense... You know, I prefer like a younger coach than Pete Carroll. I prefer a younger coach like Bruce Arians.
Has a tendency to sort of dink and dunk, right? And that is not the most effective offense. So Jared Goff this year, his average depth of target is 7.5 yards, which ranks 22nd in the league after even Kyler Murray.
Wow, that is something.
He's also been blitzed second most of any quarterback this season in total amount of blitzes. So it's kind of hard to tell exactly what the issue is here. Is Goff feeling the pressure and getting the ball quickly, or are they designing the offense around that and just trying to get passes out quick? And that's why those receivers aren't ranked higher. Like, Cooper Kupp is catching a lot of passes for not a lot of yards.
I mean, that was one of the concerns about the Rams going into the year. We talked about this with, I think we talked about this with Mina on the preseason podcast, that they replaced a couple of interior linemen with young players, and it wasn't the same group. There wasn't going to be the continuity that they had the previous season, and I think that probably has shown up a little bit.
Before then, Goff is making bad throws on about 20% of his passes, so pressure is definitely mattering and getting to him.
This is the Pro Football Reference tracking stats?
Yes.
Okay.
As far as bad
which
throws.
Are not updated through this week's games, I don't believe.
They are.
I think they said they're not updated until Wednesday.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's about to get a lot worse.
I hadn't noticed those stats until I was looking at the pages today.
And then also, Pro Football Focus this week. So it's interesting. Football Outsiders rates the Rams offensive line pretty well. And I feel like this is one of the places where maybe the raw stats are not really showing the full story, because they would show adjusted sack rate, but they're not factoring in pressures and quarterback hits in that, right?
Correct.
And just looking at sacks, which we'll talk about Aaron Donald in a second, is not necessarily an effective way of looking at something.
Yeah.
Pro Football Focus has graded the Rams offensive line the worst in the league so far this season.
Wow. That shocks me. I'm surprised it's that bad.
And so, like, Football Outsiders rates them pretty well, I think partially because of adjusted sack rate, because they run the ball fairly well. But again, we know that running is more of a byproduct of passing at the same time and being able to spread the ball out. But this team is passing more than they're running the ball. So being good at running the ball when you do it five times in a game is not necessarily that important.
Well, especially on Sunday when they threw 68 passes to 11 runs.
And so Jared Goff has also been hit as far as quarterback hits more than the opposing quarterback has, or the same amount in every single game this season. So they might not be turning into sacks, but Goff is getting pressured. And I'm saying to you in this Seahawks game, the Seahawks need to flap their wings. They need to honk. They need to be like the goose. And they need to bother Jared Goff in this game.
Untitled Thursday Night Football game.
Untitled Thursday Night Football game, because that is going to be the key to success. We need Jared Goff to put up a sign that says, no Seahawks allowed by the end, because they are going to be in his back pocket all game.
I haven't gotten far enough in the game to understand that reference. That game is obviously amazing and compelling. How much of its popularity is due to the fact that it's named Untitled Goose Game?
Oh, it's a great game, irrelevant to that.
But that, like, it piqued your interest, didn't it?
Untitled Goose Game?
Yeah. You don't think so?
I suppose so.
Okay. Let's talk about the Rams' defense, which had been really good this season as they started 3-0, despite all these concerns we just raised about the Rams' offense. They hadn't given up more than 5.7 yards per attempt in a game in their first three games before giving up 9.2 to the Bucs on Sunday. They're still 10th overall in that stat at yards, net yards per attempt allowed at 6.0, and 9th in rushing yards per attempt allowed at 3.8. As you alluded, Aaron Donald with just one sack thus far, which is usually like a good quarter for him against the Seahawks offensive line. But Clay Matthews, in his first year in LA, has come in with 5 sacks.
And people are rising from the dead. It is.
Okay. It's more. We're November 1st, I think. But
yeah, it's every day is Dia de los Muertos for Clay Matthews.
Rejuvenated in L.A. But you think that he's still been effective if you look beyond that?
I mean, I wasn't able to find the exact like hurry and pressure rate.
I mean, he's got, Aaron Donald. I think, 4 hits.
I would assume that Aaron Donald has been good.
Clay Matthews has.
Yeah, I would just be safe to say that, yeah, Aaron Donald has been good this year.
I mean, Clay Matthews has 5 quarterback hits according to Pro Football Reference, which is the same number of sacks
and
he has.
And all of them have turned into sacks.
Yeah, his new nickname is Coco. There may be some regression to the mean coming on that one.
Let's just hope that regression doesn't happen this week.
What do you mean?
Well, Aaron Donald.
Oh,
the Clay Matthews regression could happen this week, but let's say hope that it doesn't happen for Aaron Donald.
Husky legend Marcus Peters suffered a facial laceration on the pick 6 during the fourth quarter that made it a 45-40 game. Cleared concussion tests despite the big hit, but did not return for the final 8 minutes of that. He is expected to play this week. And fellow former Husky Taylor Rapp, who we were discussing earlier, is considered a game-time decision for this one.
In the Rams' secondary, Marcus Peters in particular has played very well this year. But I do think there is a bit, if you squint hard enough, there's a little bit of this old man Seahawks offense between Bruce Arians and Pete Carroll, right? There's a bit of a synergy in wanting to get the ball down the field. Pete would never in his life want to do it as frequently and as desperately as Bruce Arians does.
Yeah,
but
he wants to do it more surgically, let's say.
But as far as air yards, you know, you look at Jameis Winston and Russell Wilson, and they're awfully similar. And you look at explosive plays, and you look at Jameis Winston, and you look at Russell Wilson, and they're awfully similar. And I think that's something that the Seahawks are going to have to take advantage of in this game against the Rams.
Should we talk chances of victory?
I hate to do this to Mina and the whole Ramley, but I think it's like a 76% chance of victory.
Wow! 76%?
It is more than the Huskies have on Saturday night in Stanford.
The Seahawks are 1-point favorites in this game.
I look at this all and wow. I say, if they can get to Jared Goff, if they can pressure him in any way, Jared Goff is going to make mistakes. And also, the reality is that Jared Goff is desperate right now, right? He's desperate for a good game. He's going to be in a position to be forcing things. And if you have Jadeveon Clowney in your back pocket, if you have QJF, if you have Ziggy Ansah.
You know the Seahawks haven't been good in terms of pressure rate this season, right?
It's early.
Okay.
Ziggy Ansah hasn't played in most of those games.
I mean, he's now played in 2 out of 4, but he hasn't played in most of the snaps.
Barely played. He's just getting up to speed.
He played
Look,
more.
Look, if I can quote people defending Aaron Rodgers, he's still in preseason mode. Everybody else is in regular season mode, but Ziggy Ansah is in preseason mode.
I guess that is accurate in this case.
And was in those two previous games. But
he finally got it at the final play.
That was it. He entered the regular season for that one play. The thing that's actually very fascinating to me before we move forward is how they're going to deal scheme-wise with these three Rams wide receivers.
Oh, you know, I know the answer. They're going to play the base defense the
whole
time. But I'm
saying, like,
I mean, by the way.
I don't think that's the wrong decision. Like, the Rams are not about getting the ball downfield.
Yeah, yeah, that's fair. You may recall this year the strategy is the Cincinnati Bengals, whose offense has, you know, the shine has come off Zach Taylor a little bit since week one, I would say, when you raised the possibility that perhaps he had revitalized the Cincinnati Bengals. They did not look real or revitalized.
Have you seen the quick reads on Mason Rudolph? Because I had Juju Smith-Schuster in fantasy, and Mason Rudolph, no.
I did not see that, no.
There was no receiver in the area should be Mason Rudolph's nickname.
Wow, that's harsh.
And somehow he's like number 6 in quick reads, but Russ is number 14. I was like, Football Outsiders, be cool.
So I literally, Jalen Samuels threw 3 passes? I literally did not see a second of this game. I was driving back from Portland. I was eating dinner and then driving back from Portland. Wait, but he threw 3 passes?
I guess so. I didn't see any of that.
Oh, okay.
I think that's all in the first half.
None of
those passes was Juju Smith-Schuster.
The Bengals scored 3 points in this game. Andy Dalton had 4.6 yards per attempt and a 6.6 QBR, which makes me wonder whether the Seahawks' attempts to replicate New England's defense against the Rams in the Super Bowl may not have been effective against the Cincinnati Bengals.
Let me just say.
And you may be questioning how Jared Goff is doing. I still think the Rams have more talent on offense than Cincinnati. That's my hot take for the day.
I'll tell you, here's what I do with week one. I'm going to ball it up here. It's crumbling. And I'm throwing into the Puget Sound, because that's what you do with week one for every team.
Okay.
Week one does not matter.
Okay.
Ever. Week one does not matter. It's gone. It is gone from our minds. The most
It is not gone from my mind. It
the
is
most important thing.
Prominently in my mind.
How often when we got to week 10, when we got to a week 11 last year, were you thinking about that loss at Denver? It was a different team. It is a different team every single week that goes by.
But still a team that plans
they
to play.
They could not scheme for the Bengals.
It's still a team that values taking away the run and daring teams to pass. And as much as Goff is struggling, I still don't think that's going to work out as well for them as it did the last 2 weeks against Teddy Bridgewater and Kyler Murray.
I mean, we talked about similar quarterbacks last week.
Or even against Mason Rudolph the previous week.
Teddy Bridgewater and Tyler Murray were similar quarterbacks. I'll tell you.
I mean, I don't think Tyler Murray is similar. Sorry. I do think Kyler Murray is similar.
The most similar quarterback, let's look here. Let's take a gander to Kyler Murray that the Seahawks will have faced all year. It's Teddy Bridgewater. No, I'm joking. It's actually a knockoff. But Jared Goff is not in a different range, right? Like, we're talking Jared Goff, Ben Roethlisberger,
too much into four
Kyler
games.
Murray.
So if you look at DVOA, the Seahawks somehow slipped from 7th to 11th despite dominating the Cardinals on Sunday. I guess because of the fact that
they didn't dominate the Cardinals by enough.
I think it's probably more because the opponent adjustments actually, when they had 4 weeks of data, did show that, hey, maybe that beating the Cincinnati Bengals by
Kyler
one at
Murray
home in week one
better
wasn't
QBR
that great.
Than Jared Goff has.
Okay. I mean, he's not played well this season. But if you look at their Dave, which incorporates preseason expectations and is more predictive going forward, the Rams are still a much better team than the Seahawks in that measure. And
a much better team?
They're a comfortably better team. They're much more likely to make the playoffs than the Seahawks are. Even though they both
fifth
have
to tenth. Okay. All right.
Both have identical 3-1 records. And I don't like this matchup nearly as much as you do.
Wow.
The Seahawks still have not beaten Sean McVay. Fun fact.
They have. In LA.
In LA?
Yes.
Did win that game?
Yeah.
All right. I rescind that comment. I think they have a 45% chance of victory on Thursday.
Wow, this is probably the biggest difference in our...
I think it is. I mean...
percentage chance of victory ever.
I'm a little more pessimistic than the world at large, which, again, has the Seahawks as a slight favorite. I think that
people... I mean, people, if they're a one-point favorite, that's like a 55% chance of victory.
It's like a... yeah, something like that. I think that people are probably overreacting to last Sunday. That Tampa
what
Bay
about
game,
the Sunday
which was
before
anomalous.
Then? And then
what about it? Which part of the Seahawks losing at home to the Saints makes you feel confident that they're going to beat the Rams? I just don't even know where to go with that
I
one.
I can't believe the Saints are six and Dave, by the way.
Yeah. That
they're a very good team. I'm talking about how badly the Rams wanted to give the Browns that game.
Sure. They still won on the road.
Okay. I'll let you...
I mean...
pick against the 26-5-1 record of the Seahawks.
That's the count, a strong
on
count
national
argument.
TV. I'll let you pick for Jared Goff in this situation.
They have beaten a lot better teams than this year's Rams on national TV. That's absolutely
accurate.
They
beat Pat Mahomes last year.
It's true.
I'll tell you, I'm taking Pat Mahomes over Jared Goff.
Me too.
So I don't look at this Rams team and feel good.
I mean, I want to be wrong. I want Russell Wilson to have a performance that elevates him firmly into the MVP discussion.
Okay. I thought you were going to say just elevates him as a quarterback. I was going to say he's won a Super Bowl and went to the Super Bowl the next year.
Yeah.
Be cool. Jared Goff scored 3 points in the Super Bowl.
Russell Wilson's been this good. It's just the world may start to catch up at some point. Pete Carroll may allow the world to catch up at some point. I mean, how confident are we the good offense? We're going to see the good offense.
Against the Rams?
They may try and run and keep the offense off the field. Keep the Rams offense off the field.
We'll see. I think that Pete Carroll's saying that the way that they played in Arizona was the exact way that they wanted to win. I don't think he was too far off with that perspective.
Yes, he was absolutely not far off from that with that perspective.
I mean, the way that they won that game, they passed the ball to take the lead, and they ran the ball to win the game.
That's the way to do it.
And if they can do that against the Rams and let Jared Goff make mistakes, then do that, and they will do that, and they will win this game.
Okay.
Okay.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.